You're listening to audio from Mercy's Door Community Church in Muskoda, Illinois. If you'd like to get more information about Mercy's Door, we'd love for you to connect with us on Facebook or check us out at mercysdoor.org.
In order for us to get a good look at Phoebe, there's work that we probably need to do contextually, little history work that we need to do. I'm prepared to lead us through it this morning, but I'd like to first give you a compelling case for why we need to do it. Everything that you read, everything that you think about, everything you encounter, you interact with it. There it goes. You interact with it through a lens. We all do. We all interact with everything that we hear and read through a lens. We bring implicit bias to everything. Some examples of that might be, I heard of a story about a pastor who was doing some missionary work in Indonesia, and he was starting a seminary there, and he was teaching a Bible at a Bible class there, and part of an exam that he gave out was multiple choice. And when the students turned in their multiple choice exams, he found that several of the students left some of the answers unfilled. And so he went to the students and he said, well, you left this part unanswered altogether. And they said, well, yeah, because I didn't know the answer. And he said, well, why didn't you guess? And the student says to him, well, because what if I got it right? And he said, well, then that would be good. And she said, well, that would be lying. I didn't know the answer, and you would think that I did. And he realized that he was approaching this scenario through a certain lens, that he was, as part of his natural order, inclined to think pragmatically, where these students were inclined to value honesty over pragmatism. And he saw, okay, this is a cultural difference that fundamentally changes the way that we approach a multiple choice exam. So this is a small and simple way for us to think about, like, okay, these things, the way that we live, the way that we're raised, the things that we value, they inform the way that we think and the way that we interpret different events. Another example of this might be when you guys watch like medical dramas on TV. It's super common that like the chief of surgery of some major teaching hospital would be like some like 25-year-old stud-looking guy. Right? And we know it would be improbable that the chief of surgery at a teaching hospital would be 25 years old. And yet we see that image and we receive it easily and continue on with watching because culturally we value youth. And we value youth so much that it doesn't even hit us as odd when we put young people in settings where we wouldn't even typically see a young person, right? And so the things that you value typically don't need to be stated. Okay, the things you value typically don't need to be stated. They're implied, and we receive them readily. But that means that we have to do work sometimes in order to try to understand what our implied values are when we approach the Bible. Now, I bring that up to you to say to you that all of the Bible was written in a context that is foreign to us. And what I mean is that the first century ancient Near East was an honor-shame collectivist culture. An honor-shame collectivist culture. And it's different than what we know in the modern Western world. In an honor-shame culture, shame is not the opposite of honor. That's not what I'm trying to say. They're not pitted against each other. Dishonor is the opposite of honor. But honor and shame are two related but different tools used in this society in order to bring up conformity to the socially accepted norms. So when we think about honor in the Western world, I think we think about our personal honor because we have two things we're trying to work through here. We have our own idea about what honor is, and then we have our own idea about what is valuable, the we or the I. And so when I think about honor, I think about my honor. I think about my face. I think about my standing and the reputation that I have. But in a collectivist culture, honor and honor and shame in cultures, I am we. And we are a group. And so it's about the reputation that we have in the biblical world. It's about the honor that we have in the biblical world. And the thing about the honor of a culture when we think collectively is we actually don't see the honor of a people as waxing and waning. In this type of thinking, we actually see the honor, the amount of honor as static. What we're judging is how much you're contributing to that whole. So there's never honor removed from the collective. There's just honor removed from you. And if the honor is removed from you, then it's absorbed by somebody else. So you think honor is a pie. You've got a slice and I've got a slice. But if my slice gets bigger, then your slice necessarily gets smaller. And we actually see this play out all the time in the Bible. What you'll see is that a lot of the conversations of Jesus, that when he's talking in the public square, this is rarely ever actually about receiving information. When you're having a public discussion in an honor-shame culture, it's an honor contest. And so that's why the Bible's always trying to clarify when Jesus was in the public square discussing things or when he was in private discussing things. We'll see stories like after Jesus' public teaching, the disciples went into the house and they asked him questions. Well, why is it telling us that? It's wanting us to know that his disciples were not in an honor contest with Jesus when they asked those questions, but they actually wanted to know the answers. They were seeking information. But in the public square, there's a real honor contest happening there. It's the same thing with Nicodemus visiting him by night. He came by night because he wasn't in an honor contest with Jesus in that interaction. He was earnestly seeking information. A lot of Jesus' disputes with the Pharisees and the Sadducees were in this arena, one that is somewhat foreign to us. They really killed him over honor. He wasn't the first or the last honor killing, but you understand that they killed him over honor because Jesus is taking honor away from them in these public conversations, and he's claiming the honor which they claimed for themselves for himself. And he was shaming them for their misuse of his Father's word. Now, in order for us to kind of take that, say, okay, I think I can put myself in that context. We can't do it in 5 seconds like that, but we can try to think like, okay, what would it be like for me if I really internalized that and I really functioned that way and I really thought of myself as an honor, shame, collectivist type of thinker? Well, until we do that, we probably can't really understand the role of a patron, the role of a patron. The reason why I want to talk to you guys about the role of a patron is because of Romans chapter 16. In Romans chapter 16, this is the last chapter of a very long letter that Paul has written as a letter of introduction because he has not yet visited the church in Rome. And he is sending it by the hand of Phoebe. And in this closing part of his letter, he says, he commends her. He says, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a servant of the church at Cenchrea, that you may welcome her in the Lord in a way worthy of the saints and help her in whatever she may need from you, for she has been a patron of many and of myself as well. And so I want to kind of expose you guys to the notion of a patron in this context. I think the easiest way to do that is to use an illustration. So I want you to imagine that you are a wealthy person. Let's say that you own some gold mines and you've done really well, and so you are a wealthy business person. And I am a baker, and I'm a baker because my dad was a baker, and his dad was a baker. But my bakery has burned to the ground because a few nights ago I wasn't careful with putting out the fire, and now my living is ashes. And I could try to get a loan in order to rebuild my bakery, except my collateral is now ashes, as I said, and so I'm unable to do that. And so my neighbor says to me, listen, I've got a friend. And in the Bible, the word friend can mean several things, but it never means buddy. And the role of a patron was commonly called a friend, and the client of a patron was often called a friend. So this neighbor says to you, I've got a friend, and I'm going to go see him in the morning. Why don't you come with me? He may be able to help you. And so he goes, and he lines up with all the other friends of this wealthy benefactor, and they bring to him their needs. And so his turn comes, and he brings his needs. And then he says, and I'd like to introduce you to my friend, my neighbor here. He's got a problem he'd like to tell you about. And so now you, as the baker, tell this friend of a friend about your problem. Now, this patron, this benefactor, is under no obligation to help you. It's virtuous. It's considered virtuous for you to help somebody in need, but you don't have to help. You can't help everybody, but for whatever reason, this patron decides to help you. And he says, listen, I'm going to give you some money to rebuild your bakery. I've got some friends who work in Mud Brick, and they're going to help you rebuild your bakery. I've got some friends who are carpenters, and they're going to help you get this thing rebuilt. And so they do that. But there's something implied in the receiving of that gift. After the bakery is rebuilt, at that point, I am now your friend. As the baker, I am now your friend. And as your friend, you now consider me to be part of your household in this ancient environment. I'm now part of your household. You would literally say that. You would call it that. This is a member of my household from now on. So that now when I bake bread, I'm baking it for you and I'm baking it for all of your friends. And you're going to make sure that I get a fair price when I'm selling my bread to you and to your friends. And you're going to make sure that I'm selling my bread at a fair price for others, that I'm not charging too much. So now you and I are in an ongoing relationship because you are my patron and I am now a member of your household. That gift that you gave me has a special term for it in the ancient world. And the way that I'm supposed to respond by being loyal to you has a special term for it on account of the fact that I'm now a member of your household. And that gift that you gave me was called charis. And the response of loyalty that I give to you is called pistis. And we translate those as grace and faith. In fact, the only time that we see grace and faith used together in that way is when we're talking about patronage. So when in the Bible we read Paul say things like, by grace you have been saved through faith, everybody in that context would hear that and say, oh, patronage. Patronage, so that's cool. So God is like our patron. And that's exactly what he's saying. So patronage is this picture that God uses for our relationship with him where he says, for every morning from now on, you're going to line up with all of his other friends and you're going to stand there and you're going to wait your turn. And if you need something from him, you're going to let him know. And then you're going to ask him, and do you require anything of me today? And this principally was something very easy for them to understand in the first century. And it's something we need to work a little bit to understand, which is why we've done that work. Now, Paul calls Phoebe his patron. He says of her, she has been a patron of many and of myself as well. So I want you to hold on to that identifier as Phoebe as we continue to understand what Paul is teaching us about who she was to him and who she was in the church. Paul considered Phoebe to be somebody who gave him honor. He hitches his honor to her, and he hitches her honor to him. And he says, she's been my patron, not just my patron, but the patron of many. Now, I claimed when I opened the sermon that Phoebe is the one who's delivering this letter to the Romans, and I don't want to ask you guys just to take my word at that. And so I don't want to walk you through that. But first, I think we have to talk a little bit more about literacy in the ancient world. I think that today, when we talk about literacy, we're always talking about reading and writing. We say that if a person is literate, they can read and write. But in the ancient world, when you say that somebody is literate, you just mean that they can read. They can't necessarily write. Now, the reason for that is because any first grade teacher would tell you that writing is a function of practice. If you can read, you can write. You could sit there and struggle to make the shapes that you're able to read, but becoming a good writer takes practice, right? But in the ancient world, you weren't typically carrying the stuff around that you would need to write, and then even if you were at home, you would need to have the supplies. You need to be able to mix your own ink. You need to be able to cut your own pens and keep them sharp. You need to be able to score your writing material in order to write in a straight line. And it just wasn't something that most people did just because of the time in which they lived. So they thought of writing as the work of secretaries. And so Paul commonly used secretaries to write his letters. It wasn't that he was illiterate. He could read, and he was able to write, but he would say things about his own writing, wouldn't he? He'd say, like, see with what large letters I write, right? Typically, what you would see is that the sender of a letter would, at some point towards the end of the letter, insert his own hand into the letter in order to certify, like a signature, that it is indeed of him, although he's using a secretary to pen it. And so you would see a change in font, so to speak, where suddenly it become big and blocky and look like a kid was writing when the person who's actually sending the letter is inserting himself into it. And you would also see more of the sender's voice come into the letter at that point because what he was saying wasn't being interpreted and flowerized and made cohesive by the work of a skilled writer like this. And so we've got a bunch of different letters that we can see, not just biblical letters, but a lot of letters from the first century that we can look to learn a lot about. And a lot of times you're going to see that the sender of the letter is only saying things like, I wish you well, or greetings from you, or whatever. If they were good at writing, that might add a little bit of content to it. But for the most part, the secretary was responsible for doing all of the writing. And then we see, like in Paul's letter to Philemon, that it's going along all delicately and rhetorically, and then suddenly you see where Paul picks up the pen because he breaks in and he says, by the way, you owe me your very life, and I'll see you soon. it's like blunt, and then it like goes back to being flowery again. And so you can kind of always tell from font change and from style change when the writer's just like, just give me the pen. I wanna say something here. And so anyways, in 3 John, you guys, we remember we were doing the 3 John sermon series, how short that was, the letter of 3 John, like this long. That is the average length of a letter in the ancient world. They averaged about 80 words. So Philemon was a good bit longer. And it would cost about $100 in modern money to send the letter of Philemon, to write and send the letter of Philemon, to pay the secretary, to pay for the supplies, to pay the courier, to get it where it was going to go. So it was an expensive thing to send a letter. And the longer it was, the longer it took, and the longer it took, the more expensive it was. And so when we say that Phoebe was a patron, we can assume that she played a role in getting the letter writing paid for as well. But that doesn't tell us that she sent it. The great letter writers from antiquity, there are some from Rome that we know, Seneca and Cicero, theirs were much longer than Philemon. Their average letters were 2,500 words compared to 80. And so they were really long ones. Paul's letters, on average, were 7,500 words. 7,500 words. 3 times longer than the longest known writers in the ancient world. So Paul took his time to really say what he wanted to say, and he used secretaries to do it well. Now we're kind of getting into this letter. So this book of Romans, many chapters long, very, very long. He's in Corinth when he's writing it, and he's got Tertius, who is he's the secretary who wrote this letter. He identifies himself in the letter, and he's sitting there with him in whatever place he's staying with Tertius, and they're spending their time writing this letter. And it's not just Paul in the room. It's Paul and his friends who are with him on the missionary journey, and it's whoever else is there. And they're all conversationally talking to the secretary to try to put everything into, because remember what Romans is, it's got doctrine, it's got updates on how things are going with them, it's got instructions for them, it's got hopes and wishes for them, it's got greetings for specific people that they know who are in the Roman church that they want to say hi to. It's like it's a communal activity for them to work together to get everybody's stuff into the letter, because writing a letter is a big deal. And writing a big letter like this is an expensive and big deal. And so it's going to take some time. And there's going to be drafts and revisions. And normally what the secretary is doing is he's just listening as there's this like stream of consciousness going. He's writing everything down. And then he's going to go home. He's going to take a day or a week, and he's going to write down a draft. He's going to bring it back. He's going to read the draft to the people. And they're going to say, oh, you know what? This would be a great spot to put in a part of that my favorite psalm, or this would be a good spot for you to quote something from the Old Testament to make that point a little bit better. And then they're going to go back, and they're going to revise it, and they're going to come back, and they're going to read it again. So it's an intensive process, writing a letter. And then once it's done, Paul's going to sign it, the final draft. If there's time, normally the practice was that the scribe would write a really nice copy so that you don't send some rag to the church to see, like they're going to send something real nice. And they're going to write one more copy that's for Paul to keep. And that's because letters get lost. And you want to make sure there's something to compare it to. On to couriers. At this point, you've done all that work. Getting your letter, very expensive letter, very weighty letter. First thing the Romans would have thought upon receiving is he sent us a book, not a letter. You want it to get there, and you want it to get there with no question as to who has written it. And this was a problem for Paul early in his ministry. We read in his early letters that forgeries had started showing up, and people were writing letters under the guise of Paul. And so Paul starts becoming selective about who he sends letters by the hand of, and then he commends the person who's carrying the letter in the letter, so that when they're reading it and when they're delivering it, the person carrying it is commended by Paul himself. Now, this is called a letter of recommendation, and it was incredibly common in the ancient world. It was necessary in the ancient world because when you move into a new area where you're unknown, you want to appeal to your reputation. Remember, I am we. You want to appeal to your reputation to people who are known. And so you would ask, as you travel into a new area, can somebody who knows people in this area send me a letter of recommendation that I might carry it as I travel? And that's what Paul's doing here in Romans 16. In fact, what you could say is that Romans 16 is a letter of recommendation for Phoebe, and attached to it is a New Testament epistle. that the main thing is Phoebe was traveling to Rome, and she needed a letter of recommendation from Paul, and so he puts that in. That's verse 1 and 2 of chapter 16. And by the way, since you're going to Rome, I've got 15 other chapters of things I'd like to say to them when you get there. And so a letter of recommendation would be carried by the person who is being recommended, and Phoebe is the person recommended to the church at Rome. So Phoebe would be the one carrying this letter. And so she is called a patron, she is called our sister, and she is the courier of the letter, and she is called a deacon of the church at Centuria. Now, I want to explore each of those titles I've done a lot of work there for you, and I'm hoping that it was helpful. What I'm hoping is that you guys will see what we can learn about Phoebe by using those words. When Phoebe gets to Rome, the question is, does she hand the letter over, wait for them to read the part where she's recommended, and then say thanks so much and leave to go whatever she was doing in Rome? Or does she play some part in actually delivering the content of this letter to the people at Rome? And this is the last thing I want to say on the ancient practice of letter writing and letter sending. Phoebe would have been responsible as the one commended by Paul to make sure that she is available to answer any questions that the recipients of the letter have about the content of the letter. As the one recommended by Paul, the people are, the way you think of a letter today is it comes in the mail, you're going to open it, you're going to read it really quick, and you're going to throw it in the trash. But in the ancient world, you receive that letter, you're sending out a word to all the brothers and the sisters, and you're saying, hey, on Thursday, John is hosting us at his house for dinner, and we're going to read this letter from Paul. So be there Thursday night, and we're going to have the letter reading. And then what you want is for the carrier of the letter to be present because she's been commended as the one to whom Paul trusts to answer any questions that you have about the details of the letter. So Phoebe's going to be there so that they're going to ask all kinds of questions. So how is Paul? How are they? Where are they going next? How's the missionary journey going? What did he mean by this? Things like this. And Phoebe, as the commended one, is going to clear up those questions because she was with them. She was hosting them. She was their patron, and she's the one who's been made responsible for carrying this to the Roman church. Now, that's a huge responsibility. And the reason why she was entrusted with that responsibility, I don't mean to bait and switch you, but I give you all of this to tell you, this is how I know, it's a debated thing, that when he says a servant of the church at Centuria, that he means the office of deacon. It's a debated thing whether or not women can hold the office of deacon in the New Testament church. And one of the ways that those who believe that women cannot carry the office of deacon, they argue it, is by saying that Phoebe's not a real example of a female deacon. It really should just be interpreted as the more generic form of the word diakonos to mean a general servant. And there are several reasons why I want to make a compelling case to y'all that women really can be deacons. Not only can be, but you're looking at one. We're talking about a woman called a servant. If you're reading the ESV, you see servant with a little number, and then your Bible is going to tell you that another word for that is deacon or deaconess. I commend to you our sister Phoebe, who is a deacon of the church at Centuria. That's my first clue, is when you want to use the general word for diakonos, it doesn't make a lot of sense for you to take that general word and then make it more specific by tacking on to it of the church at Centuria. He's making it known to the Roman church that she serves a specific role at a specific church. He's talking about a function and a role within a church. And then he says some things about her. He says, receive her in the Lord in a way worthy of the saints and help her in whatever she may need from you, for she has been a patron of many and of myself as well. So he says that she's not just a deacon of the church at Centuria, but that this is what she does at the church. She is a patron of many and of myself as well. Well, we just talked about what patron is. That means that she's bankrolling the ministries of the church, that she's funding the ministries of the church. She's taking care of tangibly the needs of the church. Well, isn't that what a deacon does? See, one of the primary functions of a deacon in the early church was to carry out the care of the body, was to be entrusted with the collected funds as the church brought their money together in order to make sure that the needs were met. And he's saying, this is what Phoebe does. She takes care of the needs of those who cannot take care of themselves, including of mine, Paul's. And then he says to them, he commands them, I'm commending her in order that you would help her in whatever she may need from you. And so he is appealing to her trustworthiness here. He's saying, whatever she asks you for, give it to her. You can trust her with whatever she asks, because she's somebody who has been a patron for many in our church, for many over here in Corinth, including for me. He's saying, if she says that she has a need, supply it, because she's a patron. Whatever she asks for, give it to her, and she's going to multiply it. Give it to her, and she's going to make sure that it is used in an honorable way to serve the body. He's describing a deacon. And so he says, I commend to you our sister, Phoebe, a deacon of the church at Centriae, however we say that, a patron of many, including Paul, and a courier of the letter to the Romans. I commend her. I instruct you to welcome her as worthy, in a way worthy of the saints, and to supply her with whatever she asks. In a collectivist honor shame culture, this is huge. He is giving her honor. He is pouring out honor upon her. He is tying his honor to her honor. In many ways, he is saying, I derive much of my honor from her. Because he's not saying, I'm her patron. He's saying, she's my patron. This is different than Philemon, where he says, don't forget, you owe me your very life. I'm your patron. When Paul was writing to the church at Colossae, he said of the courier of that letter, he permitted the church to validate the things that he was saying. He said, go ahead and ask them, those delivering you the letter, about me. Go ahead and ask them about me. They'll tell you. It was normal and regular and desired practice that the recipient of a letter would be able to clarify the details of the letter with the person carrying the letter. So he was not just saying she has honor because she gave us money. And he wasn't just saying she has honor because she's put us up, because she's shown us hospitality. And he wasn't saying she has honor because she's been a servant of the church. He's saying she has honor because she is our sister. See, he lists her qualifications in the order of significance. And the first one that he lists is she's our sister. Then she's a deacon of this specific church. Then she's a patron of many, including me, Paul. Then she's the one I've entrusted to carry this letter to you. But number one appeal is she's our sister. And it's because she's his sister that she was there and present as these proceedings of talking out loud and getting this letter written and all that were in her ears. It's why she would be able to clarify the content of the letter. They didn't debrief her. She was around. She was putting up the church. She was bankrolling the church. If anyone would know what Paul was trying to say in the letter, it'd be Phoebe. This is her letter of recommendation. You understand? He said, honor her. Give her whatever she asks. Supply her, for I commend her. The applications here. Here's the obvious one. Ladies, the office of deacon is open to you. And everything that is described as the function of a deacon, the scriptures give us incredible pictures of women doing those functions incredibly well. And so I want you to know that you're invited into that office. And if the Lord is calling you to serve the church with these gifts of hospitality, with these gifts of radical generosity, with these gifts of sisterhood, like, you're welcome. Two, I want all of us, not just the women, to see the significance of servant leadership, to see how the gospel of Jesus Christ compelled Phoebe, just like it compelled Lydia from our sermon last week, just like it compelled Mary Magdalene the week before. Like, isn't it crazy that pretty much like the whole New Testament church is just bankrolled by single women? Just like the ladies are just like, all my stuff is yours in service to the proclamation of the gospel and the advancing of the kingdom of God. In response to the gospel, Phoebe, like so many other examples, just empties herself in service to the church. I also want to highlight for both men and women that Paul regarded women as trustworthy. Like, he put the book of Romans, my favorite book of the Bible, I think one of the most significant books of the Bible, into Phoebe's hands and said, get it to where it's going and make sure they understand. They're trustworthy. The gifts of hospitality and generosity cannot be overstated. You must give of what is yours because nothing's yours. I know how hard that notion of the we, of I am we, is for us. But it is distinctly Christian. We are one. I am you, you are me. We are brothers and sisters, but we are all in Christ. And he has poured out richly of his grace upon each of us. Jesus Christ emptied himself of his glory. He emptied himself, becoming obedient to the point of death on a cross, being found in the likeness of men. Obedient to the point of death on a cross, he did not count equality with God as a thing to be grasped or held onto. But today, he is risen on high as his enemies are being made his footstool, so that every knee in heaven and on earth will bow and confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Why? Because he emptied himself, laid himself down to ransom the church unto himself. He purchased what was already his by emptying himself. And you want to hold on to what's mine, to what's yours, to what you earned? It's never so with a deacon. I also want to highlight the beauty of the interconnectedness of the church. The way that the church of Corinth, the scribe Tertius, the deacon Phoebe of one church is then sent to go minister to the church in Rome. We're going to read, I decided not to preach it this morning, but right after verse 1 and 2, you see all of the greetings, all these people by name in Rome, that they're like, oh, say hi to them. Say, oh, and don't forget to say hi to him. And oh, and don't forget to say hi to her. And I wonder how many people had their hi's to put in there. But they'd met so many Roman Christians on their missionary journey so far, although they'd not made it to Rome yet. Such that by the time they're sending a letter to Rome, they've got so many people they want to give greetings and love to. There's this interconnectedness in the church that's really beautiful. And I want you guys to embrace that and to not become like loyal to Mercy's Door in such a way that you forget that we're part of a much larger whole, a work that Jesus is doing all over the globe. And to remember, your brothers and sisters in here are uniquely special to you, but you've got brothers and sisters all over the globe. And we have a ministry of encouragement and service to one another, regardless of where they are. It's one of my favorite things about being in a military community is that although I hate sending you guys out, every time my wife will remind me, Adam, like, we've got brothers and sisters all over the globe now. I can't tell you how many times it comes up that I'm traveling and like people that used to be members here happen to be in the city where I'm traveling and get to put me up for a night or serve me dinner or whatever. It's beautiful. And it's on that same note that I want to make one more application about commendation, and this is particularly for the military families in the room. That practice of writing a letter of recommendation is somewhat dead in the modern world, but it's not at Mercy's Door. One of the areas of feedback that I've heard from many military families over the years is that what's discouraging about being restationed is that you go into a new context and nobody there knows anything about you, and so you can't bring your Christian reputation with you. Maybe you were a pastor at your last church, but to them, you're just a stranger. And so it's like starting at square one, trying to like prove that you're in the brotherhood before you can be received in to continue the very things that you'd always done at your last church. That's where the role of a letter of commendation comes in the ancient world, and it's the way that we treat it today. And so all you need to do is ask. And what we'd love to do is help you pick your next church at your next station. Call up those pastors of that church before you arrive. Let them know that you're coming and what you mean to us. Testify that you are a sincere brother or sister in Christ and the many ways that you've been a blessing to us while you've been among us. And then commend to them that they receive you in the likeness of the saints and invite you all the way in and supply all of your needs. And in that way, we then get as the shepherds to feel like we have handed your care over into somebody else's keeping, and that's an exhale for us that we can know that you're going to be well cared for at your next station. This is who we want to be. And it's how the first century church functioned. Ladies, Phoebe is a beautiful example. Men, she's a beautiful example to all of us. There is an attribute of hospitality and generosity and trustworthiness that is highlighted in each of these examples as I've been doing this sermon prep that just says to me, obviously Jesus wanted us to have an attitude toward the sisterhood that really sounds like we are one. And in our one-on-one conversations, then I'm going to be done applying, in our one-on-one conversations, it's always one of two ways. Either you are a woman, and your self-speech says to you that a sister is less than a brother. Or you are a man, and your external speech says that a sister is less than a brother. And what I want to remind you guys is that Jesus said that in the kingdom of God, the last will be first. See, a lot of times we want to focus on all the differences and all that one gets to have and that one doesn't get to have and all of that. But if we see that the last is first, then that means that leadership means the lowering of oneself. That if all of the leadership positions in the church or all of the best positions in the church are the ones with all the glory, then we're not getting it. Because Jesus said that leadership in the New Testament church means dying to yourself. It means washing feet. You're not supposed to, in your flesh, want to do what I do. Want to make the calls that I want to that I have to make, want to say the things I've got to say, want to do some of the ministry that I've got to do. But that's only if I'm actually being a shepherd. But if we say that these positions are actually these things and we glorify them and make them something different than what the Bible describes, then we're going to become competitive about who can climb to the top, much like the disciples did, arguing over who gets to sit at Jesus' right hand in the kingdom. But listen, the last will be first. If you desire to lead in the church, then die to yourself and walk in the way of Jesus. That applies to both women and men. And I want you to remember, I think it was Benton who was talking to me about this earlier this week, that when we see the differences highlighted between men and women, especially in Genesis, that before we get to any of the beautiful distinctions in the way that God designed us, first we celebrate the similarities. That what Adam proclaims when he looks at Eve is, this at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, for she was taken from the man. He celebrates how she's like him, not how she's unlike him. And then we come to understand the beauties and the distinctions between them. But the first celebration is how they are one. In church, we are one. And it's in this way that Paul says there is therefore now neither male or female, nor Jew nor Greek, or slave or free, because we are to have unity in the body of Christ. Let's pray.